Friends, this is Susie Larson, and thanks so much for listening to this podcast of Live the Promise. To learn more about the show and to listen to other Live the Promise shows, log on to myfaithradio.com. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome to Hour 2 of Live the Promise. I'm Susie Larson, and if you just tuned in, you missed my first hour discussion with Pastor Tommy Barnett, talking about his book, The Power of a Half Hour. He, to me, is one of the legends and such a pillar in the faith, and if you missed it, you got to go back and listen again, because he talked about his faith history. He talked about dreaming with God in ways that are impossible with man. I was so inspired by that first hour. Check it out on our website, myfaithradio.com. Well, now we're switching gears. We're going to talk. You know what the Bible does say? We're made in God's image, but because of just the onslaught of messages from our culture, we kind of get our image mixed up because we tie it into what we see in the media. And we're going to talk body image. We're going to talk eating disorders. We're going to talk to a woman who's been there. She's been on the show before. In fact, we received a lot of response when she was on the first time. And I just personally connected with her heart to heart as a sister in the Lord. And she's from the Twin Cities area. She's got a book out titled Table in the Darkness, A Healing Journey Through an Eating Disorder. Lee's been there before, but now she helps and ministers to many who struggle in the same way she once did. Her name is Lee Wolf Bloom, and let me tell you about her, and we'll get her on the show. In fact, I have to pause because I forgot. I got to say, sorry, Matt, you're so calm looking that he doesn't even look stressed out at all. Talking to my producer here, Faith Radio is partnering with Angel Tree Ministries this Christmas to bring the gospel to children with a parent in prison, and so only $84 will help you reach six children with a Christmas gift, the gospel, and a message of love from their incarcerated parent. And so our goal this year is to reach 1,000 children. We're well over halfway, but we only have a week left. So we need your help if you want to reach some children with the gospel and with a gift, with some encouragement, because their parent or parents are in prison this year. You can find more information on our website, myfaithradio.com. So before we hear from Lee, let's hear a clip from someone who's been touched by Angel Tree.
Michael Carrion, pastor at Promised Land Covenant Church in New York City, the Bronx, shares an Angel Tree story that is very personal.
Let me tell you the story about a little 9-year-old boy. His mom and dad were heroin addicts, and they paid for their habit by taking that little boy and his younger sister up to people's homes, knocking on their doors, and asking for a drink of water for their children. Once inside, a couple would pull out knives and guns. They would begin to tie up and just rob and pillage every apartment they walked into. As you can imagine, the children who were exposed to this life of trauma and violence were damaged goods. They were lost, fearful, broken. The father is arrested. Several weeks after that, so is the mother. The grandparents of these children had rose up as a champion and fought for them not to go into the foster care system. Soon after that, just before Christmas, there was a knock at the door. There's a tall African-American gentleman there. And he asks the grandmother, is Mike and is Letty home? And as they come to the door, this tall man says, I know that your mother and father can't be here with you, but they love you. And these gifts are for you. Daddy can't be here. Mommy can't be here. But we want you to know that Jesus is here for you. As this man prayed, he felt a presence come into the hallway of this project building. Years later, this young man goes down the same path that his parents went, finds himself addicted to crack cocaine. He has a friend that tells him, I'm not going to leave you lost. He's taken to a evangelistic outreach service. As this young man is responding to that call, he remembers the visit of a man in the project hallway. Life changed for this young man. Soon gets involved with the local church and learns that Jesus stepped out of glory, put on humanity, so that he would not be lost. My name is Reverend Dr. Michael Carrion, and more than 20 years later, God has continued to work a miracle in my life. That seed planted that day positioned me to respond to the call of Christ, to perpetually serve, to reach out and to evangelize on Rikers Island. We covet your prayers here in the South Bronx. There are so many kids that are lost. Pray for the Angel Tree kids, not only in the South Bronx, but all over the country. I believe that revival will start because of angel tree seeds that are planted by the missionaries that would bring the good news.
Pastor Michael Carrion pastors a church right in the neighborhood where his parents were arrested. He also planted 6 churches in the Bronx, with plans for 14 more. Pastor Michael was an angel tree kid. This year, there are hundreds, perhaps thousands of little boys just like Mike who could grow up to be dedicated, humble, eager servants in God's kingdom. In every case, it starts with an angel tree gift, which means it starts with you.
Wow, that's a powerful story. And if that doesn't speak to the power of a half hour of making yourself available to be a necessary miracle for someone else, wow, amazing. If you need more information on Angel Tree, you can find it on our website, myfaithradio.com. And as I said, we're switching gears now. We're going to talk about eating disorders. We're going to talk about God's ability to roll up a sleeve and pull you out of the pit of despair, and even how you see yourself as God sees you. And maybe you love someone who you suspect has an eating disorder. Lee's the person, I think, to talk to today. So get your calls and questions ready. We'll open the phone lines in here in just a moment. Let me tell you about Lee, and we'll get her on. Lee Wolf-Bloom is a health educator at the Melrose Center for Eating Disorders in St. Louis Park, Minnesota, where she helps run the Eating Disorder Chemical Dependency Team, aiding those who struggle with dual diagnosis of eating disorders and CD to help them find hope and freedom. She also speaks regularly, sharing her story of hope at churches, schools, and conferences. You can find her on the web at LeeWolfBloom.com. Lee, welcome back to the program. Welcome in studio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Good to be with you. Well, you've been on before, so you know we love to start talking scripture. So is there a verse you want to share with us today?
You know, I don't have a particular verse. I more just can't. I love that song you just played.
Yeah, I know.
And I just love the words, greater is the one living inside of me than of the world. And right now with the holidays, I just need that message. Mm-hmm. So that's really what's on my heart today.
Greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world. And I always, I sometimes have Matt play that song a little bit long because that one part of the song, it says, there are days when I lose the battle, but grace says that it doesn't matter because the cross has already won the war. I just think the more that we see ourselves as he sees us, the more freely we'll live.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, you, we have so much to talk about, but let's, for those who didn't hear our first conversation, let's go back. I want you to give some backstory maybe on your childhood journey and just some of the first sort of landmarks that sort of pointed you towards an eating disorder, maybe stirred insecurity or fear in you or identified something in you that compelled you to move towards controlling your life through your diet.
You know, I always like to say part of it was I came into a family of 4 bursting with energy. I was number 3, so I made it 5. And my dad used to say, you know, tables aren't made for 5 and roller coasters aren't made for 5, which was a joke. But to me, I had an early on message that number 5 was not good enough. And as I grew older and my personality tended to be pretty boisterous and loud and people were telling me to slow down and to calm down and be quiet, I continued to get that message, the repeated message that there was something flawed about me. There was something that maybe wasn't good enough. And then when my parents divorced, I somehow internalized it as it was because I maybe did something wrong and maybe I could be better. And so I went on this mission at a young age to be better, to do better. I became a Christian in high school and pursued my faith as another way to be better. And I never measured up. It never seemed like I could measure up for God or the world because I was striving in my own will. When I got to college, I started developing later in high school. And so when I got to college, I gained some weight and somebody had made a comment to me, oh, look who has gained the freshman 15. Now, the freshman 15 is actually a very normal thing that happens to people in their 20s because they're growing more womanly figures. But I took it as there's something wrong with me.
And pause. Why do people do that? You know what I mean? Especially to a girl.
I don't know.
I don't imagine guys like hearing that either. But really, what am I supposed to do with that?
Right.
Right?
Right.
Okay.
I think the intention was out of love as because I was becoming more womanly looking. But to me, I took it as there was something wrong. And especially, you know, in our culture, you know, we do a lot of fat shaming and, you know, oh, now you're saying I'm fat and I've got to do something about that and I've got to fix this. I started fixing it, but it was happening at a time when emotionally I wasn't very stable. I was starting to feel really overwhelmed, starting to really show signs of early depression. This was the early 90s. And that combined with trying to control my diet, control my weight, started to spin out of control. And very quickly, I lost weight rapidly and became ill. And I had no idea. I had no idea what was happening. I just knew that I needed to be better, and that the hole just kept getting deeper and deeper and deeper, and I kept digging and digging and digging until I ended up in a hospital.
Would you call that a slippery slope? I mean, I know we talked last time that there's sort of a genetic tendency or maybe makeup towards someone who might who can diet and come through it without ending up in this pit of despair.
Right.
But if you have that genetic makeup, is it kind of flirting with the edge the more you give in to that kind of managing your life through diet?
Yes, and actually, I was just talking with patients recently about this. It's a very frustrating feeling to be like, why can't I diet? Everyone in this, you know, our society diets, but I genetically, whatever it is, am made up different. And for me, it became a drug for me. So it could have been anything. It could have been drugs, alcohol. I was using it to cope, but for my makeup, I couldn't stop. And oftentimes when I work with alcoholics, they will say, you know, why is it that they can have one drink and I can't? But there's just something different about me versus somebody else who can stop when they diet. So I always like to say, you know, you have to remember that there's a genetic component, but there's also, for it to take hold, for an eating disorder to take hold, you have to have the genetic predisposition to addictive behavior. You have to have an overwhelming environment. So college oftentimes tends to be a pretty overwhelming environment. And then an overwhelming set of emotional circumstances. I was going through a lot of emotional stuff with my family, with my body, with my own journey in life. And that just pulled the trigger and the floodgates opened and I couldn't stop without help.
And so initially you were high producing really in college.
Yeah.
So you
mm-hmm.
always felt like you couldn't be enough, but you were more than enough from the outside looking in because you're a high achiever, very competent.
Yeah.
For a while you were looking good because you're running and you're losing weight and your friends maybe and even guys noticed.
Right.
But there's a point where you crossed over and it was dangerous. And I've heard this from others who've been, you know, through the valley of anorexia, saying that initial thought is you're just jealous because I'm losing all this weight and it's your own private world that you can control. Is that how it's felt?
Absolutely. And denial with a big old capital D. Mm. You know, I was president of my sorority. I was in plays. I was making straight A's. I was performing. And people would say to me, you know, how do you do that? You have so much self-control. And then the line started crossing to where I didn't start to look healthy anymore. And then people started to stare and started to say, we're very concerned about you. And I kept thinking, they're just jealous, which that was my disease really taking over. I had no idea.
Because they were starting to be concerned.
Yes.
And wow, we have so much more to talk about. If you want to chime in, we've got a handful of copies of Lee's book, Table in the Darkness, A Healing Journey Through an Eating Disorder. And this book isn't just from someone who's been there. She now helps those and helps those get out of the valley of these disorders and helps identify them. So if you love someone who's dealing with this disorder, maybe you yourself are, you can even call anonymously if you get on the air or you're able to email me with a question. You'll get a copy of the book. Up to 5 copies, 877-933-2484, 877-933-2484. Make sure you mention if you don't want us to mention your name on the air, and also email Susie@myfaithradio.com. More with Lee Wolf-Bloom in a moment. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. I have my friend Lee Wolf-Bloom in studio today. Title of her book is Table in the Darkness, A Healing Journey Through an Eating Disorder. I really want to encourage you to call in if you've got a question and you're wondering about eating disorders. Love to hear from you. 877-933-2484. So you open your book, Table in the Darkness, with a gripping story of a time when you were close to death. And I'm wondering, Lee, I know I can only imagine it's probably hard to revisit that, but would you do that for us? Just tell us about that time, what led up to it, and what happened after it.
Well, I had been through treatment, and I had you know, taken my family through the ringer, as it felt like to me, through treatment, in and out of treatment, trying to get better, trying to do what the doctors were telling me. But there was a part of me that really still wanted my eating disorder to help me cope. And I just couldn't do it anymore. I started to feel like it was never going to be possible. I didn't feel any hope. And I also started to really feel like I had failed God. I kept praying, you know, God, heal me and heal me. And I wanted that magic wand. And it wasn't coming fast enough. And I stopped taking my medication and sunk into a really dark place and tried to take my own life. The sad and amazing part of the story was the boy who I was dating at the time woke up in the middle of the night knowing that there was something wrong and came to where I was banging on the door and found me lying in a pool of vomit. Which that boy is now my husband.
But amazing.
By the grace of God, you know, who knows what woke him up, but I got a second chance. And it was at that moment where, you know, I was laying there in the intensive care and I realized, you know, I'd heard it before that insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. But I knew God was standing there saying, I'm right here and I'm offering you a second chance. I'm offering you a way out, but you won't walk in. And so, you know, I like to say that, you know, an eating disorder is not a choice. Nobody chooses an eating disorder, but recovery is. And I really had to make that choice in relationship with Christ. Hey, you know what? I'm going to step into this relationship with you, God, instead of me just waiting for God to magically heal me. He was there all along, but I really needed to step in and say, okay, let's do this together.
Boy, that is so insightful that the disorder in itself is not a choice, but recovery is. And I think that needs to be heard for those who maybe listen and go, well, just eat, just put on weight. It's the same thing as saying to the battered wife, just leave. And you don't quite understand the dynamics associated with it. And so maybe unpack that concept a little bit more. Why is it not a choice?
It's not a choice because what happens is similar to somebody who takes a drink and can't stop drinking is that it becomes almost just takes you over. The mental piece of it, when you're malnourished and you're obsessed and you have ruminating thoughts, it's not rational. The things that you do to manage your sadness or not feeling good enough or whatever it is, this coping skill becomes such an obsession that you can't stop it. And just you can't just pray it away. You can't just, you know, white knuckle it away. You've got to get help and you've got to have other people coming in and helping you make that choice, which I had. I had a lot of people surrounding me helping me make that choice, but the choice was made 1,000 times every day. You know, I'm going to get up, I'm going to eat my meals, I'm going to go to therapy, I'm going to take my meds, all these different things. And it was the hardest thing I've ever done.
And it's downright heroic, Lee, and it's even more heroic to me that you've invested yourself in helping so many people. And here's a question I've wondered as I've heard other people's stories who've dealt with this as well. When you're in treatment and they're issuing you the invitation, is the conflict in your head, because what I've heard from other anorexics who just get suspicious of people trying to help them, saying, you know, I don't want to get fat. Is that the fear? You're going to make me get fat? Or is the fear, this is my coping mechanism, and if you take away my only ability to control my situation, I don't have the goods to control the pain that I'm feeling? Is that the truest thing, or is the fat thing equally important?
You know, it's different for everybody in terms of what the eating disorder purpose serves. For me, it served the purpose of not feeling. I had so many emotions, and as I mentioned before, I tended to be a pretty passionate person and was told just through life that my passion was too much. So I was just numbing out. So for me, it was a fear. If I start feeling, what's going to happen to me? And also a fear of, will anyone like the real me? Because the me with an eating disorder is toned down. The me with an eating disorder is controlled. What happens when that's not there anymore? Yes, there's many people who, you know, whatever their history is with food and weight, sometimes it's the fear of fat that does it. But more often than not, it's the fear of feeling out of control. And when we have lots of emotions, we sometimes feel very out of control. So having that kind of control then helps you stay in line. But you can't numb out bad feelings without numbing out good feelings.
Wow.
So when I lost sadness, when I lost the ability to cry and the ability to feel sad things, I also lost the ability to feel joy. I lost the ability to laugh uncontrollably, because you're just so numb. You're just not even functioning normally, which is not how God wants it.
Wow, that is such a great insight that you can't numb out the bad feelings without also numbing out the good feelings. And, I was reading some of your story in your book, and I've already been through this book the second time, but feeling like a sadness for the little girl again and again, and thinking about, of course you would doubt your value if you feel like you're the fifth person at the table. I mean, was it scary for you to untangle some of those feelings because you love your parents? But in some ways, some of the messages they sent your way without meaning to hurt you. I mean, and I think what I've heard as we've worked with youth is there's almost a protection, like, I can't let myself feel this all the way because I can't bear to hurt the parents who hurt me because I love them. So instead they self-destruct inside. Did you deal with that dynamic at all?
Oh, that's a really good question, one I haven't been asked before. Yes, I think there was more than anything, it was more of just toning me down, that the me that God created, the me that was coming out, wasn't one that was right, that it didn't fit in. The thing is, though, that I think back, my parents now, we have this wonderful relationship. They were doing the best they could with what they had, and they were giving me also a lot of love. The way I interpreted the messages, it was something with my wiring and the way I interpreted the messages. I still to this day tend to be a very sensitive person, which helps me in my work. It's a gift, but it also, because I was so wired to take things so sensitively, that it hurt more than it probably would have the average person.
Wow.
The other piece, though, was there wasn't room to talk about feelings. And that I think is also a generational thing. I think this generation now is much more talking about shame, talking about being vulnerable. So I didn't know what to do with those emotions. I knew I didn't feel right. I knew I didn't fit in. And I knew I just needed to achieve, but I didn't know how to express that. And maybe if somebody had come to me and said, how do you feel? And given me room to explore my own emotions and that it's okay to cry. It's okay to get angry. It's okay to be hyper, but that's all in hindsight. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe I still would have developed an eating disorder. I don't know.
How did Chris respond to you? That's your husband now, who found you. How did the dynamic of the relationship change after you got out of the hospital?
Yes, that was a very rocky situation. So I'm in the intensive care unit, and basically there were many people telling him to run and run fast, including his family, telling him he was crazy to marry to consider ever marrying somebody like me who had so many issues, and would I starve my children, and would I attempt suicide later in life? And he stuck with me, which
and he won the prize.
I don't know. We've been married 18 years.
Wow.
And he stuck with me and we worked through it together. But, we talked openly and we went to therapy way before we were ever even engaged. And we worked it through. It was hard, but it was completely worth it. And, not every situation works out like that. But at the same time, he was willing to see the me beyond my eating disorder.
Such good stuff. Talking to Lee Wolf Bloom about eating disorders, her story through the valley and out again, and how she's helping other people. Man, you've been quiet the last couple of days. Maybe you're out Christmas shopping, so you need to put this phone number in your speed dial. If you've got questions about eating disorders, here's the number, 877-933-2484. More with Lee Wolf Bloom in just a moment.
Death is lost and victory won. You were born to change it all. A warrior though frail and small. Just a baby sleeping in a...
So glad glad you tuned in. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. This second hour of Live the Promise, we're talking about eating disorders. And Lee Wolfblum has an amazing story of her own journey through an eating disorder. And I love now that she's turned the table on the enemy of her soul, and she helps many, many more people recover from that same thing. And here's a quote from your book, Lee, that I thought was just, it sort of stopped me in my tracks. You said, "What if I keep growing?" I think this is you in college. Is this right? Yep. "What if I keep growing? What if the puffiness around my middle never stops? I stood in front of the full-length mirror in my dorm room and inspected the extra parts. These extra parts needed fixing. My stomach, my thighs, and those cheeks that were round and puffy, like two big apples on the sides of my face. I would fix this. Fixing was my forte." And you do address the issue of control and how that's such a significant part of this whole eating disorder. Talk about the issue of control and how that feeds it, and in a negative way.
Well, if I can control the outside, then I don't have to pay attention to what's going on my inside.
Oh, very good.
So as long as I focus so much on what's going on the outside, I just don't need to feel anything. So really what I was trying to do was, I knew there was something going on the inside that was making me so overwhelmed, so I controlled by that. You know, and one other thing that I really think is at core of this as well as the control is a feeling of shame. And shame is different than guilt. You know, Brené Brown, an author who's a researcher on shame, talks a lot about how we think, you know, guilt is when you've done something wrong, and shame is when you feel as if you are wrong. And so I really, that's shame for me. I felt like I was wrong. I needed to be different instead of embracing the person that I was. But shame is such a horrible feeling.
Yeah.
You know, it's this thing that makes us feel like we need to hide.
Like you can't get apart from it. Like,
yes,
it's in your skin. It's a,
yeah,
part of you. When you started to untangle some of the fears and the anxiety and the pressure that you were feeling, how long before the light started to go on for you and you thought, you know what, healing is a possibility for me? I mean, this last time after you went to the hospital,
right,
and were engaging in your healing process, how long before you felt that?
Well, you know, in the eating disorder world, they like to say it's an average of 2 years in terms of to get to recovery. But I would say within, when I started eating consistently and started going to therapy and taking my meds and doing what I needed to do, I would say within a month, I started to notice little things such as being excited or laughing, not being as rigid. So I would say just really that second time, you know,
wow,
the other times, you know, oftentimes it takes falling down and getting back up, falling down and getting back up until recovery is really going to stick. So it took a while, but yeah, I started to, there was little glimmers, and those little glimmers, I knew, you know, the whole verse about if you have a mustard seed of faith, I knew if I had, you know, just a little bit of hope that maybe tomorrow I'd have even a more bit of hope, you know. If that sentence made sense.
No, but, I'm tracking,
you know,
exactly. Yeah.
And I knew each day, the more choices I made towards life and the less choices I made towards the eating disorder would be a winning game. And so I just, every day I'd kind of play this game with myself, like, okay, how many choices have I made towards life today? And that meant like getting up and talking about what was going on, eating my meals, when I felt emotions, expressing them. And I knew those were games toward goals towards life versus, you know, numbing out, which would take me back down the other road.
I love what you just said, that we could really learn a lesson from this question. And how many choices have I made towards life today?
Mm-hmm.
Because just because you don't have an eating disorder doesn't mean you make choices that sabotage your dreams and sabotage,
okay,
who you are. And how did Chris verbalize changes that he saw in you as he saw you come back to life again? What was his role in all of that?
Chris was a fantastic, and still to this day is a pretty amazing man. What a gift from God. You know, he would say to me, "I love you, but I hate your eating disorder." And we'd sit down for meals, and he would say, "You know, I don't want to have dinner with your eating disorder." So he just called it what it was, called it out. And yes, then he would start to see things. And I remember him saying this, and I continued to say this to family members as well. He would say this all the time, like, "The light in your eyes has come back on," you know, and that has nothing to do with weight. So I couldn't fight with him about that. I couldn't say, "Oh, I'm fat," or, you know, "There's something wrong with me." He'd just say, "You know, the light in your eyes has come back. That's the Lee I love." And so that, and, you know, really kind of helped spur me on, continued to give me more hope to push forward.
And so you're a professional now and you help others. Do you still struggle at times with a fear of weight gain, or how do you manage that? Or is it sort of something that's of your past and you sort of are in a totally different mindset now?
I'm really in a totally different mindset.
That's really great. And that's hopeful for somebody listening today, I'm sure.
I really, you know, I often don't know my weight. I am very protective of my recovery. And as long as I'm protective of my recovery, I know that my body will do what it needs to do. And that's where I had to kind of, later on in my journey, I had to kind of come to this place with my body, like, hey, we're friends. You know, we're not competing against each other anymore. And my body is here to be a part of me. And so now what I do to protect my recovery is I'm very vigilant about certain things, never skipping meals, making sure I take good care of myself, staying away from things that potentially could be sending me down the wrong path. And because of that, my body has stayed pretty much the same. I mean, like I said, I don't check my weight. And I've had children because
amazing.
I'm not playing around with my metabolism. And there's so much more in life to think about and to do than what I look like or, you know, what I weigh. I mean, I put my makeup on in the car. Don't tell anyone. But, you know, like, I just don't care. I mean, I care, but I just...
It's not an idol to
it's
you
no,
anymore.
No. And God can free us of that. And I do believe it's 100% possible. And the reason why I do the work I do, when I was in treatment, I never met anyone who had recovered. I'd never met anyone who struggled. And when I say recovered, does that mean I couldn't possibly relapse? Maybe, you know, potentially someday I could, you know. The eating disorder, though, is in a locked room deep down, far, far away. And the only one who can unlock that deep, dark room is me. And so that's why I'm very careful not to get anywhere near that room and to fill my life with so many things and my relationship with Christ and so that I don't even need to go near that room. And I promise you, like, life on the other side of it, you couldn't even pay me $1 million to go back to ruminating thoughts, to caring what I weighed, to not even being able to pay attention because I wasn't nourished. You know, on the other side of it, life is so much more fun.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking of just your story and how you're helping so many people. To me, the before and after story is such a picture of the thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy. But I come, Jesus says, to give you life and life abundantly. And abundantly is a spilling over life that is healing and wholesome to you, but nourishing to others. And it's just so like him to say, I want to rob everything about you. And as I'm like even reading your story as a child, and like the mom in me loved you, I'm just like, what a darling, adorable little girl. And isn't just like,
about that.
No, maybe because you're a remind me a little of myself, but anyway, which is scary, right? But I mean, the idea that the enemy would right away, because he saw your potential before you ever did, and I think that's true for all of us, that he goes for our voice or our sense of identity before we even know we have one, so that we can spend our life doubting it and sabotaging relationships. And I look at what God is doing in you now. It is just powerful and amazing. Here's a question for you. I always have more questions than we have timely, but when you first have, I would assume it's mostly young gals that you deal with. I mean, I know what anorexia affects young men, but probably not as often.
It's 20 million women and 10 million men
are
the statistics right now.
Wow, that's significant.
A lot.
Wow. So when you first meet patients who are just into the program, what are the first things that you're trying to get to the bottom of?
Well, it depends on what level of care that they're in. So oftentimes if they're in an inpatient unit, they're going for medical stabilization. So that's kind of the first priority. But really, like when I'm working with patients, I can always, no matter how sick somebody is, I can always see the person underneath, the person in there, and really see how the eating disorder has kind of exactly what you said, you know, taken away this person. So we're really just trying to uncover kind of what they're running from, what they're using it to cope from. And that's really more, you know, the therapist's job to really dig deep and find out. You know, oftentimes it's trauma. Oftentimes it's a life-changing event that just pulled the trigger and things got out of control. But the age group, unfortunately, it's growing to women in their 30s more than it has, especially in the last 10 years. And I would say part of why that's happening is the life-changing events. People are, women are getting married later. Women are having babies later. There's a lot of pressure to lose weight after the baby and a lot of media pressure. And so then the trigger kind of maybe for something that had been dormant for years is pulled sometimes even in the later 30s. So back to the question about what we're looking for, you know, for every person it's different. And it's the bummer about this disease and is about drug and alcohol addiction is that there's no one way for treatment. There's no one right way for any person. Like what worked for me might be different for somebody else, what's going to work for them. So we're really always trying to figure out, you know, what's gonna work for somebody. And you just never know. But I can say what I have seen in patients who come in so taken by the eating disorder, and when they start to live again, it's like watching a flower because you start to see them coming alive. You start to see them laughing again and their personalities coming out. And that's what God sees. You know, he's like, there's a person in there that I created that's pretty amazing and awesome. And life and this world and Satan have stolen that person. And so if we in our society can do more to allow people to just grow and be that person and not hold on to these alternative coping skills that can kill us.
And not to have a one-size-fits-all, actually an impossible one-size-fits-all picture of what we as women are supposed to look at.
Right.
Because, I mean, the pictures that we even see of gorgeous models who are gorgeous in themselves, they're Photoshopped, they're touched up, they're not even them. And so and it's impossible. And so the average framed person can't even get close to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we live in this perpetual state of failure. I mean, it's no wonder we want to medicate and default to things because we can't measure up.
Well, I was just at my son's school play in junior high. And when you look at teenage girls in sixth grade on a play stage, you see that God has created all different types of bodies.
Mm.
There's not just one type of body. And to think that we're all going to fit into this mold, you know, and to me, that's God designed us all different. Why not just be the person that God designed you to be and, you know, celebrate what that looks like instead of trying to mold it to be, conform to be what our society is telling us we're supposed to look like.
Wow. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about just if maybe you love someone and you're wondering, are they managing their diet a little too much? Are they too concerned talking about their weight too much? Just some tips for maybe discerning if someone's on the road towards an eating disorder and how you'd make the distinction between somebody with a significant eating disorder and somebody who maybe just has body image issues. They're different and they can be. Lee will talk about that when we come back. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Tuning in, I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking to Lee Wolfblum about eating disorders, about her journey through her own eating disorder. Now she's a professional who helps so many more. And Lee, we've got a listener who emailed and says, glad you're talking about this. Have a friend I'm convinced has a problem with an eating disorder. She's not at a point where it's physically visible or maybe the full-blown disorder, but she's definitely has food body image issues. She's in her 40s, and I think this is an issue that's been on and off a problem for a very long time. What I've heard from her and her sisters, from her sister, she does not see that she really has a problem. She won't eat meat, often will not eat in front of others. I already ate, she says. I've tried hinting to her to no avail on eating better, and she needs to eat more. We spent the whole day together at a conference, and all she ate was a small plate of pasta, tons of water, Diet Coke, and coffee. So here's the question. How do I go about confronting her? Do I say, look, I'm really concerned you have an eating disorder? Or is that too blunt? I've been told she probably won't receive it. How do I approach her? Can you give me some good wording? Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks for writing in. So it's hard because, you know, if your friend was sitting there doing drugs, you would say something. Mm-hmm. But with eating, it becomes a very tricky situation. But there are some things that you can do that will be kind of a straight shot to really addressing this. And that is to observe what you've done, observe what you've noticed about her, and then say that to her. And use the words, I notice. And so instead of saying, I think you have an eating disorder, you say, I notice when we're at a conference, you're not eating. I notice that you, what else you notice? Do you notice that she's isolating? I notice that you seem very anxious. I notice that you talk about food a lot. I notice that the spark is gone in your eyes. So you say those things and then say, would you be willing to go? And so would you be willing is a great way to say it, because that's inviting them in. It's not forcing them. Would you be willing to go and talk to somebody about it? And then if I were you, hey, you have some numbers on hand. You know, where I work, the Melrose Center is in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. It's a great place. We have other places in Minnesota. So have a number on hand. And if you're going to do this with your friend, then you need to stay with them through the course. Don't just confront them and then run away. But you say, I'm willing to go with you. I'm willing to go with you to the appointment if that will help you. And then most likely they're going to be angry. Most likely she's going to deny, but you continue to lead them to the water. So you continue to say, you know, what can I do to help? How can I be a friend to you during this? I notice these things. It's tough. You know, sometimes it takes a couple times, but to do it in love and relationship is also the best way to do it. I think oftentimes people will see somebody and they want to say to them, oh, you have an eating disorder. And it's like, well, if you're not in relationship with them, it's more attacking.
And it's an assessment. And Right. Then you're not a safe person. So just Right. Really praying, too, for the right time so her heart is ready. And Mm-hmm. You said last time we were on that you could have, you know, a lot of body image issues and even maybe an obsession for how you look in your jeans. And that doesn't necessarily mean you have an eating disorder. So maybe make the distinction between the two.
I would say that most of our society has a poor relationship with food and has probably a poor relationship with our bodies. You know, you just turn on any talk show or hear somebody talk about their body in an airport. Usually it's a woman, you know, kind of dogging her own figure. But just because somebody is doing that doesn't mean they have an eating disorder. An eating disorder is a medical illness. So when it crosses the line from disordered eating, which is a poor relationship to food, to a life-threatening eating disorder, there are some distinctions. And you can go on the National Eating Disorder Association website to kind of see what the distinctions are. But, you know, an example would be Thanksgiving. You know, at Thanksgiving, oftentimes families don't eat all day, and then they eat the Thanksgiving dinner. Well, that doesn't mean everyone's got an eating disorder because they didn't eat all day. But if you notice that somebody does that every day, then that's definitely something to be concerned about. But trust your gut. You know, if you like she said with her friend who was not eating all day, you know, trust your gut and ask God to direct you, because usually you might be onto something. And if you intervene early enough before they even develop into an eating disorder, you might be helping them. Mm. But not everybody who diets develops an eating disorder, but most eating disorders start with a diet.
Say that again.
Not everyone who diets develops an eating disorder. So you think about me and my sister. We grew up in the same household, probably similar messages. She dieted, but she didn't develop an eating disorder. And she doesn't have, really, in my opinion, doesn't have the personality to ever develop one. But not everyone who diets has an eating disorder, develops an eating disorder. But an eating disorder starts with a diet. Research shows that most eating disorders start because somebody's just dieting. Like, oh, I'm going to go on a diet, and then, you know, at a time in their life that's overwhelming, combined with their potentially genetic predisposition, and it leads out of control.
And so what is happening genetically that your sister wouldn't have that predisposition, but you would? What is that?
Well, that's a really interesting question that most eating disorder professionals talk about at conferences. They haven't identified necessarily that there is a specific gene, but there's definitely addiction tendencies. So if you were to look at a family history of somebody who, you know, if you're wondering, do I have an addiction tendency? Just look at your family history. Are there alcoholics? Are there addicts? Do you have a lot of people who smoke? You know, and you can just look at the family tree and see that it's there.
And also what I've heard, tell me if this is a myth, but with anorexics, especially, they tend to be high achievers, very intelligent, very competent. And so if there's an addictive tendency in the family line, this at least at first seems like a more respectable route to go.
Right, right. Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, definitely anorexics tend to be much high achievers, perfectionists. And then there are many other eating disorders as well, and there's different personality traits. But you can also say just because somebody is a perfectionist doesn't mean they have an eating disorder.
Right.
You know, so it's just something that goes along with the bag of having an eating disorder.
Do you see a common denominator when you're looking? You mentioned trauma or, you know, past childhood trauma or like the perfect storm of stress that's sort of the catalyst to launching someone in to this full-blown cycle. Have you seen a common denominator? Do you hear like similar stories again and again, or are they just as wide open as the sea?
I would say that they're similar in terms of for each type of eating disorder. For like an anorexic, it would be a little bit different than a bulimic, because most research shows that bulimia has a higher rate of people who've had sexual trauma. So versus an anorexic. So, but yeah, usually it is a perfect storm of an overwhelming set of emotional circumstances of something happened, whether it's a divorce or going off to college or somebody died or some big event that kind of pushed them over the edge.
Hmm.
That's usually an event that they can go to. But oftentimes, too, people can go in and out of it for 10, 15 years. But the good news is, you know, if you get help early on, you know, for me, I had only had it for a few years and I got help early on. Thankfully, my parents, you know, did really great job of getting me help early on. If you get help early on, the research also shows that the recovery rate is better.
Wow. Interesting.
So it's important, especially at a younger age. You know, if you know somebody who's in junior high or high school, you know, when they're growing, they need to get help right away, because you can, you know, nip it then before it turns into a life-threatening eating disorder.
So, Lee, what are some things a parent absolutely should do and absolutely shouldn't do if they suspect that their child is heading in that direction?
What they shouldn't do is ignore it. I can't tell you how many parents who the school will call or the doctor will say something, and the parents will say, oh, well, they're just a picky eater, you know. If you start to see some symptoms, you know, some signs of odd eating behaviors, and start to see rapid weight loss, especially in a younger person, you definitely should even just call a treatment center and ask someone, you know, call a treatment center, call a therapist and ask, you know, is this a sign of an eating disorder? Or go to the National Eating Disorder Association's website. You know, just be aware of the signs and symptoms so that you can be on it sooner rather than later. And then what parents, you know, oftentimes parents will, because of our obesity, parents will say, oh, my kid needs to go on a diet, or notice they've gained weight and put them on a diet. And I would say that's definitely something you should not do. A child's normal growth pattern is to go out and up and out and up.
Hmm.
So that's how they grow. And so oftentimes I think we get so afraid because of this, you know, the constant stuff in the news about obesity. But yet, you know, you don't want to put your child, make them afraid of food at a young age. So just allowing them to eat in moderation, to ask them, instead of saying, is this good food or bad food? Just ask them, you know, are you getting fuel? Are you eating foods that will fuel you up, and not attaching emotions to food? So that was kind of a lot, but
no, I love that. In fact, you mentioned that last time about connecting food to fuel, because
yes,
it has a function, mm-hmm, and it doesn't. It sort of takes some of the power away from it to bring value and validate you. You know what,
right,
I'm saying? Or
yeah,
it becomes this object that you manage. Well, of course, again, I've got about five more pages of questions that we haven't touched, so you got to come back again, because I would love to just talk about this as we head into the season where everybody's dieting and everybody's,
yeah,
trying to take off their holiday weight and all that other stuff. We got lots to talk about. But as we wrap up, Lee, I'm thinking of the person who's the parent whose heart is broken because they can't reach their child because they're just not wanting to help yet. Would you pray for this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lord Jesus, I just thank you so much for Susie and her energy, and I thank you for this time. And out there, Lord, that parent who's just aching and longing for their child to break free from this eating disorder, I pray for them, Lord, that you would move drastically in that child's heart and provide resources, not only for the child, but for the parents, so that they can fill up their love tank as well during this very difficult time. And I just pray for protection and change so that they can become the people that you created them to be, God. And I just hate it that Satan tries to take amazing people away because of this disease. And we just pray that you could just take them back, Lord Jesus. And for that parent, to just pray for their heart and for your protection and your love. In your son's name.
Amen. Amen. Lee, thank you so much for joining us
in
studio. Great. Always great to have you.
death is lost in victory.
So glad you tuned in. Hope you found some encouragement here. You've been listening to Live the Promise. I'm Susie Larson. You can find a podcast of today's program on our website. Again, check out Lee's book, Table in the Darkness. And remember this, I say it to you every day. The Lord wants you to last long and finish strong, and He is the one who keeps you strong to the end. Have a blessed night. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.